She sorrowfully dove down into the water and made her way home to her father's castle. She had always been quiet and pensive, but now she was even more so. Her sisters asked her what she had seen on her first time up above, but she told them nothing. Many an evening and morning she would rise up to the spot where she had left the prince. She saw how the fruit in the garden grew ripe and was picked. She saw how the snow melted on the high mountains. But she did not see the prince, and so she always returned home sadder than before. There her only solace was to sit in her little garden and throw her arms around the beautiful marble statue that looked like the prince, but she neglected her flowers. As if in a wilderness they grew out over the pathways, weaving their long stalks and leaves into the branches of the trees so that it was quite dark. Finally she could bear it no longer and told one of her sisters, and then all of the others instantly found out about it, but no one else, apart from a couple of other mermaids who didn't tell anyone except their closest girlfriends. One of them knew who the prince was. She had also seen the splendour aboard the ship, and knew where he came from and where his kingdom lay. "Come, little sister," said the other princesses. With their arms around each other's shoulders, they rose up out of the sea in a long row, right in front of the place where they knew the prince's castle stood. The castle was built of gleaming pale yellow stone, with great marble staircases, one of which reached all the way down to the sea. Magnificent gilded domes rose above the rooftop, and between the columns that surrounded the whole building stood marble images that looked alive. Through the clear panes of the tall windows they could look into the most splendid halls, hung with costly silk curtains and tapestries, and all the walls were adorned with enormous paintings that were a pleasure to see. In the middle of the largest hall splashed a great fountain. The spray reached high up toward the glass dome in the roof through which the sun shone on the water and on the lovely plants growing in the huge basin. Now she knew where he lived, and that's where she went, swimming through the water on many an evening and night. She swam much closer to land than any of the others had dared. She even went all the way up the narrow canal beneath the magnificent marble balcony that cast a long shadow over the water. Here she would sit and gaze at the young prince, who thought he was quite alone in the clear moonlight. Many an evening she watched him sail with music aboard his splendid ship, where the flags fluttered. She would peek out from the green reeds, and if the wind caught her long silvery white veil and anyone saw it, they thought it was a swan lifting its wings. Many a night, when the fishermen lay anchored at sea by torchlight, she heard them say so many good things about the prince. It made her happy that she had saved his life when he was drifting on the waves, half dead. And she remembered how firmly his head had rested on her breast, and how fervently she had kissed him. He knew nothing of this, could not even dream about her. She grew more and more fond of human beings. She wished more and more that she might rise up among them. Their world seemed to her much larger than her own. They could fly across the sea in ships, climb the highest mountains far above the clouds, and the lands they owned, with forests and fields, stretched much farther than she could see. There was so much she wanted to know, but her sisters couldn't answer all her questions. That's why she asked her old grandmother, who was very familiar with the world above, which she quite rightly called the lands above the sea. "If humans don't drown," said the little mermaid, "can they live forever? Don't they die like we do down here in the sea?"
"Of course they do," said the old woman. "They have to die too, and their lifetime is much shorter than ours. We can live 300 years, but when we cease to exist, we become nothing more than foam on the water, without even a grave down here among our loved ones. We have no immortal soul. There is no more life for us. We're like the green reed. Once it is cut, it will never be green again. Humans, on the other hand, have a soul that lives forever, lives on after the body has turned to dust. It rises up through the clear air, up to all the shining stars. Just as we rise up from the sea to look at the land of the humans, they rise up to the lovely unknown places that we will never see."
Why weren't we given immortal souls? Asked the little mermaid sadly. I would give all 300 years of my life to be a human for just one day and then have a share in the heavenly world.
You mustn't go round thinking about that, said the old woman. We're much happier and better off than the humans up there.
So I'm going to die and drift like foam on the sea? No longer hear the music of the waves or see the lovely flowers and the crimson sun? Is there nothing I can do to win an eternal soul?
No, said the old woman. Only if a human were to love you so much that you were dearer to him than his father or mother. If he clung to you with all his thoughts and love, and had the priest put his right hand in yours, promising faithfulness now and for all eternity, then his soul would flow into your body, and you too would share in the happiness of humans. He would give you a soul and yet keep his own. But that will never happen. That which is so lovely here in the sea, your fishtail, they consider hideous up on earth. They don't know any better. Up there you have to have 2 clumsy pillars that they call legs in order to be beautiful.
Then the little mermaid sighed and looked sadly at her own fishtail.
Let's be happy, said the old woman. We should leap and bound for the 300 years that are ours to live. Surely that's long enough. And later you can rest in your grave all the more content. Tonight we're going to have a royal ball.
And there was such splendour as has never been seen on earth. The walls and ceiling of the great ballroom were made of thick but clear glass. Hundreds of enormous seashells, rose red and grass green, were lined up on either side. A fire burning blue lit up the entire hall and shone through the walls so that the sea outside was illuminated. Countless fish were visible, big and small, swimming toward the glass wall. On some of them gleamed purplish-red scales, on others they looked like silver and gold. Down the middle of the hall flowed a wide, rippling stream, on which the mermen and mermaids were dancing to their own lovely songs. No humans on earth have such beautiful voices. The little mermaid sang more beautifully than anyone else, and they clapped their hands for her. For a moment she felt joy in her heart, because she knew that she had the most beautiful voice of anyone on earth or in the sea. But soon she started thinking once more about the world up above. She couldn't forget the handsome prince, or her sorrow at not possessing, as he did, an immortal soul. That's why she slipped out of her father's castle, and while everything inside was song and merriment, she sat sadly in her little garden. Then she heard the sound of hunting horns echoing down through the water, and she thought, "Now he's probably sailing up there, the one I love more than my father or mother, the one my thoughts cling to and in whose hand I wish to place my life's happiness. I would risk everything to win him and an immortal soul. While my sisters are dancing inside my father's castle, I'll go to the Sea Witch, the one who has always terrified me. Maybe she can offer help and advice."
End of Disc 2.
Then the little mermaid left her garden and set off for the roaring maelstroms. Beyond them lived the witch. She had never gone that way before, where no flowers grew, nor seagrass. Nothing but the bare grey sandy bottom stretched toward the maelstroms where the currents, like roaring mill wheels, swirled around and pulled everything they seized down into the depths. She would have to pass between these crushing whirlpools in order to reach the territory of the Sea Witch. For a long section there was no other path than over hot, bubbling mire. The witch called it her peat bog. Beyond it stood her house in the midst of a peculiar forest. All the trees and shrubs were polyps, half animal and half plant. They looked like 100-headed snakes growing out of the ground. All their branches were long, slimy arms with fingers like slithery worms. They rippled, joint by joint, from their roots to their very tips. They wrapped tightly around anything in the sea that they could grab, and they never let go. The little mermaid was quite terrified as she stood there at the edge. Her heart was pounding with fear. She almost turned around, but then she thought about the prince and a human soul, and that gave her courage. She tied up her long, fluttering hair so the polyps wouldn't be able to catch her by grabbing hold of it. She pressed both hands to her breast and flew off, the way a fish can fly through the water, in among the hideous polyps that reached out their supple arms and fingers toward her. She saw how each of them was holding something that it had caught. Hundreds of tiny arms were wrapped around it like strong iron bands. Humans who had perished at sea and sunk into the deep peered out as white bones from the arms of the polyps. Rudders and sea chests were held in their grip, the skeletons of land animals, and a little mermaid they had caught and strangled. For her, that was the most terrifying of all. Then she came to a great, slimy clearing in the forest where huge, fat water snakes romped, showing off their disgusting yellowish-white bellies. In the middle of the clearing, a house had been built from the white bones of shipwrecked humans. There sat the sea witch, letting a toad eat from her mouth, the way humans let little canaries eat sugar. She called the hideous fat water snakes her little chickens and let them swarm over her big spongy breasts.
"I know what you want," said the sea witch. "How stupid of you. But I'm going to grant you your wish, because it will bring you misfortune, my lovely princess. You want to get rid of your fishtail and instead have two stumps to walk on like a human being, because then the young prince will fall in love with you and you can win him along with an immortal soul."
With that, the witch began laughing so loudly and horribly that the toad and the water snakes fell to the ground, tumbling all around.
"You've come just in time," said the witch. "By tomorrow, when the sun comes up, I wouldn't be able to help you until another year had passed. I'm going to make you a potion to take with you. Before the sun comes up, swim to land, sit down on the shore, and drink it. Then your tail will split in two and shrink to what the humans call charming legs. But it will be painful. It will feel like a sharp sword is passing through you. Everyone who sees you will say that you're the loveliest human child they've ever seen. You'll keep your graceful movements. No dancer will ever glide as you do, but every step you take will feel like you're treading on a sharp knife and make your blood flow. If you're willing to endure all that, then I'll help you."
"Yes," said the little mermaid in a quavering voice, thinking about the prince and about winning an immortal soul.
"But remember," said the witch, "once you've taken human form, you can never be a mermaid again. You can never come back into the water to your sisters or to your father's castle. And if you don't win the love of the prince so that he forgets his father and mother and clings to you with all his thoughts and lets the priest place your hand in his so that you become husband and wife, then you won't get an immortal soul. On the first morning after he marries another, your heart will burst, and you will become foam on the water."
"That's what I want," said the little mermaid, and she was as pale as death.
"But you also have to pay me," said the witch. "And it's not a small thing that I demand. You have the loveliest voice of anyone here at the bottom of the sea. You're probably thinking of using it to charm him, but your voice you must give to me. I want the best thing you possess in return for my precious potion. My own blood I have to give you to make the drink as sharp as a double-edged sword."
"But if you take my voice," said the little mermaid, "what will I have left?"
"Your lovely figure," said the witch, "your graceful movements and your expressive eyes. Surely you can use them to captivate a human heart. Well, have you lost your courage? Stick out your little tongue. I'll cut it off as payment, and then I'll give you the powerful potion."
"Agreed," said the little mermaid, and the witch put on her kettle to brew the magic potion.
"Cleanliness is a good thing," she said, and scoured the kettle with the water snakes, which she tied into a knot.
Then she made a cut on her breast and let her black blood ooze out. The steam formed the strangest shapes, fearsome and dreadful. The witch kept putting new things into the kettle, and when it was boiling properly it sounded like a crocodile crying. Finally the potion was ready, and it looked like the clearest water.
"There you have it,"
said the witch, and cut off the little mermaid's tongue, so she was now mute and could neither sing nor speak.
"If the polyps happen to grab you on your way back through my forest," said the witch, "toss a single drop of the potion at them, and their arms and fingers will burst into 1,000 pieces."
But the little mermaid didn't have to do that. The polyps shrank from her in terror when they saw the shining potion that glowed in her hand, just as if it were a sparkling star. In this manner she quickly passed through the forest, the bog, and the roaring maelstroms. She could see her father's castle. The torches had been extinguished in the grand ballroom, and no doubt everyone was asleep inside, but she didn't dare go to them, now that she was mute and about to leave them forever. Her heart felt as if it would break with sorrow. She slipped into the garden, took a flower from each of her sister's flower beds, blew thousands of kisses toward the castle, and rose up through the dark blue sea. The sun had not yet come up when she saw the prince's castle and mounted the magnificent marble staircase. The moon was shining wondrously bright. The little mermaid drank the fiery bitter potion, and it felt as if a double-edged sword passed through her delicate body. She fainted and lay there as if she were dead. When the sun was shining over the sea, she awoke and felt a searing pain, but right in front of her stood the handsome young prince. He fixed his coal-black eyes on her, making her lower her own, and she saw that her fishtail was gone. She had the most charming little white legs that any young girl could have, but she was quite naked. That's why she wrapped herself in her long, thick hair. The prince asked who she was and how she happened to come there, and she gave him a look that was so tender and yet so sad with her dark blue eyes. Not a word could she say. Then he took her by the hand and led her into the castle. Each step she took, as the witch had warned her, felt as if she were treading on pointed awls and sharp knives, but she gladly endured it. Hand in hand with the prince she moved as lightly as a bubble, and he and everyone else marvelled at her graceful gliding walk. She was given precious garments of silk and linen. In the castle she was the most beautiful of all, but she was mute. She could neither sing nor speak. Lovely slave girls dressed in silk and gold appeared to sing for the prince and his royal parents. One sang more beautifully than all the others, and the prince clapped his hands and smiled at her. Then the little mermaid grew sad. She knew that she used to sing much more beautifully. She thought, "Oh, if only he knew that in order to be with him I had to give up my voice for all eternity." Now the slaves were dancing a graceful, swaying dance to the most glorious music. Then the little mermaid raised her beautiful white arms, stood up on her toes, and floated across the floor, dancing as no one had ever danced before. With every movement her loveliness became ever more apparent, and her eyes spoke deeper to the heart than all the songs of the slave girls. Everyone was delighted, especially the prince, who called her his little foundling. She kept on dancing and dancing, even though every time her feet touched the ground it felt as if she were treading on sharp knives. The prince said that she would stay with him forever, and she was allowed to sleep outside his door on a velvet cushion. He had men's clothing sewn for her so that she could go out riding with him. They rode through the fragrant forests where the green branches slapped at her shoulder and the little birds sang from behind the fresh leaves. With the prince she climbed up the steep mountains, and even though her delicate feet bled so that the others noticed, she merely laughed and followed him until they saw the clouds sailing below as if they were a flock of birds heading for foreign lands. Back home at the prince's castle, when the others were asleep at night, she would go out to the wide marble stairs to cool her burning feet by standing in the cold sea water. Then she would think about everyone below in the deep. One night her sisters came, arm in arm. They sang so sorrowfully as they swam through the water. She waved to them, and they recognized her and told her how sad she had made them all. Every night after that they visited her. One night she saw, far in the distance, her old grandmother, who had not been to the surface for many years, and the Sea King wearing his crown on his head. They stretched out their hands toward her, but didn't dare come as close to land as her sisters. Day by day the prince's affection for her grew. He loved her the way you might love a good, dear child, but it never occurred to him to make her his queen, and she had to become his wife or she would never have an immortal soul. On the morning after he was wed, she would become foam on the sea. "Aren't you more fond of me than of all the others?" the little mermaid's eyes seemed to say whenever he took her in his arms and kissed her beautiful forehead. "Yes, you are dearest of all to me," said the prince, "because you have the best heart of any of them. You are more devoted to me, and you look like a young girl I once saw but will probably never find again. I was on a ship that went down. The waves carried me to land near a holy temple where many young girls were in service. The youngest of them found me on the shore and saved my life. I saw her only twice. She was the only one I could love in this world. But you look like her. You have almost replaced her image in my soul. She belongs to the holy temple, and that's why my good fortune has sent you to me. We will never part." "Oh, he doesn't know that I saved his life," thought the little mermaid. "I carried him across the sea to the forest where the temple stands. I sat behind the foam and watched to see if any humans would come. I saw the beautiful girl that he loves more than me." And the mermaid sighed deeply. She could not cry. "The girl belongs to the holy temple," he said, "and she'll never come out into the world. They will never meet again. But I'm here and see him every day. I will care for him, love him, offer him my life." Everyone said that now the prince was supposed to marry and take as his wife the lovely daughter of the neighboring king. That's why he was outfitting such a magnificent ship. People said the prince was going to visit the lands of the neighboring king, but it was actually to visit the neighboring king's daughter. He would take a large entourage with him. The little mermaid shook her head and laughed. She knew the prince's thoughts much better than anyone else. "I have to go," he had told her. "I have to see the beautiful princess. My parents demand it, but they would never force me to bring her home as my bride. I cannot love her. She doesn't look like the beautiful girl in the temple, the one you resemble. If ever I should choose a bride, it would more likely be you, my mute foundling with the expressive eyes." And he kissed her red lips, played with her long hair, and placed his head on her heart, making it dream of human happiness and an immortal soul. "You're not afraid of the sea, my mute child, are you?" he said when they stood on board the magnificent ship that would carry him to the neighboring king's lands. And he told her about storms and becalmed seas, about strange fish in the deep, and what his diver had seen there. She smiled at his tales, because she knew better than anyone else about the bottom of the sea. In the moonlit night, when everyone else was asleep except the helmsman who stood at the wheel, she sat near the railing of the ship and stared down into the clear water. She thought she could see her father's castle. At the very top stood her old grandmother with a silver crown on her head, staring up through the turbulent currents toward the ship's keel. Then her sisters rose up to the surface. They stared at her in sorrow and wrung their white hands. She waved to them, smiling and wanting to tell them that she was well and happy, but the cabin boy was approaching, and her sisters dove down, so he continued to think that the white he had seen was foam on the sea. Next morning the ship sailed into the harbour of the neighbouring king's magnificent city. All the church bells were ringing, and trumpets blew from the tall towers while soldiers stood with fluttering banners and flashing bayonets. Each day there was a celebration. Balls and banquets followed one after the other, but the princess was still not in attendance. They said she was being brought up far away in a holy temple where she was learning all the royal virtues. At last she arrived. The little mermaid was eager to see her beauty, and she had to admit that she had never seen a more enchanting figure. Her skin was delicate and glowing, and behind her long dark lashes smiled a pair of deep blue loyal eyes.
"It's you," said the prince. "You're the one who saved me when I lay like a corpse on the shore." And he pulled his blushing bride into his arms. "Oh, I'm much too happy," he said to the little mermaid. "The best thing of all, what I never dared hope for, has been granted to me. You'll rejoice at my happiness, since you are more fond of me than all the others." And the little mermaid kissed his hand, feeling as if her heart were already breaking. The morning after his wedding would bring her death and turn her into foam on the sea. All the church bells rang, and the heralds rode through the streets proclaiming the betrothal. On all the altars burned fragrant oils in precious silver lamps. The priests swung vessels of incense, and the bride and groom joined hands and received the bishop's blessing. The little mermaid stood there in silk and gold, holding the bridal train, but her ears did not hear the festive music. Her eyes did not see the holy ceremony. She was thinking about her death night, about all that she had lost in this world. That very same night the bride and groom went on board the ship. Cannons roared, all the flags waved, and in the middle of the ship a costly tent of gold and purple had been raised with the loveliest cushions. That's where the bridal couple would sleep in the cool, quiet night. The sails billowed in the wind, and the ship glided easily and smoothly over the clear sea. When it grew dark, colourful lamps were lit, and the sailors danced merry dances on deck. The little mermaid couldn't help thinking about the first time she came to the surface and saw the same splendour and joy. She too began whirling along in the dance, darting like a swallow does when it's being pursued, and everyone cheered in admiration. Never had she danced so gloriously. It felt as if sharp knives were cutting into her delicate feet, but she didn't notice. The pain in her heart was much sharper. She knew that this was the last evening she would see the one for whom she had abandoned her family and her home, given up her lovely voice, and suffered endless daily torments, although he never knew. This was the last night that she would breathe the same air as he did, see the deep oceans and the starry blue sky. An eternal night without thought or dream awaited her, since she had no soul and could not win one. Everything was joy and merriment on the ship until long after midnight. She laughed and danced with the thought of death in her heart. The prince kissed his lovely bride, and she played with his black hair, and arm in arm they retired to the magnificent tent. It grew quiet and still on the ship. Only the helmsman stood at the wheel. The little mermaid rested her white arms on the railing and looked to the east for the red of dawn. She knew that the first ray of sunlight would kill her. Then she saw her sisters rise up from the sea. They were as pale as she was, and their beautiful long hair no longer fluttered in the breeze. It had been cut off. "We gave it to the witch, so she would help us and you wouldn't have to die tonight. She gave us a knife. Here it is. See how sharp it is? Before the sun comes up, you must stab the prince in the heart. When his warm blood drips on your feet, they'll grow together into a fishtail and you'll be a mermaid again, and can come back into the water with us and live out your 300 years until you turn into dead, salty sea foam. Hurry! Either he or you must die before the sun comes up. Our old grandmother is grieving so that her white hair has fallen out, just as ours fell to the witch's scissors. Kill the prince and come back. Hurry! Do you see that red stripe in the sky? In a few minutes the sun will come up and you must die." And they uttered a strange, deep sigh and sank into the waves. The little mermaid pulled aside the purple drapes of the tent and looked at the lovely bride sleeping with her head on the prince's breast. She bent down and kissed him on his beautiful forehead, looked up at the sky where the red of dawn was shining stronger and stronger, looked at the sharp knife, and then fixed her eyes once more on the prince, who in his dreams called his bride by name. She was the only one in his thoughts. The knife trembled in the mermaid's hand, but then she flung it far out into the waves. They shone red where it fell, and it looked as if drops of blood were trickling up from the water. One more time, with her eyes half glazed, she looked at the prince. Then she threw herself from the ship into the sea, and she felt her body dissolve into foam. Now the sun rose out of the sea. Its rays fell so gentle and warm on the deadly cold sea foam, but the little mermaid did not feel death. She looked at the bright sun, and above her hovered hundreds of lovely, transparent creatures. Through them she could see the white sails of the ship and the red clouds of the sky. Their voices were melodious, but so ethereal that no human ear could hear them, just as no earthly eye could see them. Without wings they floated through the air, carried by their own lightness. The little mermaid saw that she had a body like theirs. It was rising higher and higher out of the foam. "Who am I joining?" she said, and her voice rang like those of the other creatures, so ethereal that no earthly music could reproduce it. "The daughters of the air," the others replied. "A mermaid has no immortal soul, and can never have one unless she wins the love of a human being. Her eternal life depends on an outside power. The daughters of the air have no eternal souls either, but through good deeds they can create one for themselves. We fly to the warm countries where the sultry, pestilent air is killing human beings. There we fan a cool breeze. We spread the scent of flowers through the air and bring relief and healing. After 300 years of striving to do what good we can, we will be granted immortal souls and share in the eternal joy of humans. Poor little mermaid, you've tried with all your heart to do the same as we have. You've suffered and endured, raising yourself up to the world of the sylphs. Now, through good deeds, you too can create an immortal soul for yourself in 300 years. And the little mermaid raised her clear arms up toward God's sun, and for the first time she felt tears. On the ship there was life and commotion once more. She saw the prince with his beautiful bride looking for her. Mournfully they stared out at the frothing foam, as if they knew that she had thrown herself into the waves. Invisible, she kissed the bride's forehead, smiled to the prince, and then rose up with the other children of the air into the crimson cloud that was sailing in the sky. "In 300 years we will float like this into God's kingdom." "We might come there even sooner," one whispered. "Invisible, we float into human houses where there are children. For each day that we find a good child who makes his parents happy and deserves their love, God shortens our time of trial. The child doesn't know when we might fly through the room, and if we then can smile with joy at the child, 1 year is subtracted from the 300. But if we see a naughty and bad child, then we have to weep tears of sorrow, and every tear adds another day to our time of trial."
The Emperor's New Clothes. Many years ago there lived an emperor who was so terribly fond of beautiful new clothes that he spent all his money on dressing elegantly. He didn't care about his soldiers, didn't care about the theatre or driving in the woods. All he cared about was showing off his new clothes. He had a dress coat for every hour of the day, and just as people say of a king that he's in the council chambers, here they always said, "The emperor is in the dressing room." In the big city where he lived, everything was exceedingly pleasant, and every day scores of strangers appeared. One day, 2 swindlers arrived. They claimed to be weavers, and said they knew how to weave the loveliest cloth imaginable. Not only were the colours and patterns extraordinarily beautiful, but the garments they sewed from the cloth had the peculiar property of being invisible to any person who was unfit for his position or inexcusably stupid.
"What lovely clothes they must be," thought the emperor. "By wearing them, I could find out which men in my kingdom are unfit for the positions they hold. I could distinguish the clever from the stupid. Yes, I must have these clothes woven for me at once."
And he gave the 2 swindlers a great deal of money so they would begin their work. and they did set up 2 looms and pretend to work, but there was nothing at all on their looms. They promptly demanded the finest silk and the most magnificent gold, which they stuffed into their own bag. Then they sat at the empty looms and worked far into the night.
"I'd certainly like to know what progress they've made with the cloth," thought the emperor.
But he actually felt a bit uneasy about the idea that someone who was stupid or not suited to his position wouldn't be able to see it. Now, he certainly didn't think he needed to be afraid for his own sake, but he still wanted to send someone else first to see how things were going. Everyone in town knew what a wondrous power the cloth possessed, and everyone was eager to see how inferior or stupid his neighbour was.
"I'll send my honest old minister over to the weavers," thought the emperor. "He's the best one to see how the cloth looks, because he is wise, and no one is more attentive to his position."
Then the venerable old minister went to the hall where the 2 swindlers sat working at the empty looms.
"God save us," thought the old minister, and opened his eyes wide. "I can't see a thing."
But he didn't say that. The 2 swindlers invited him to come closer, and asked him if it wasn't a beautiful pattern and lovely colours. Then they pointed to the empty loom, and the poor old minister opened his eyes even wider, but he couldn't see a thing, because there was nothing to see.
"Good Lord," he thought, "could I be stupid? I've never thought so, and no one must find out. Am I unfit for my position? No, it won't do at all for me to say that I can't see the cloth." "Well, you're not saying anything about it," said the one who was weaving. "Oh, it's exquisite, quite the most charming of all," said the old minister, peering through his glasses. "That pattern and those colours, yes, I shall tell the emperor that it pleases me no end."
"That's very gratifying," said both weavers.
And then they mentioned the colours by name, and the unusual pattern. The old minister listened carefully so he would be able to repeat everything when he returned home to the emperor, and he did. Then the swindlers demanded more money, more silk and gold. They needed it for the weaving. They stuffed everything into their own pockets. Not a thread was put on the loom, though they continued, as before, to weave at the empty loom. The emperor then sent over another venerable official to see how the weaving was going, and whether the cloth would soon be finished. The same thing happened to him. He looked and looked, but since there was nothing but the empty looms, he couldn't see a thing.
"Well, isn't it a beautiful piece of cloth?" said the 2 swindlers, as they displayed and described the lovely pattern that wasn't there at all. "I know I'm not stupid," thought the man. "Am I supposed to be unfit for my position? That would certainly be ridiculous, but I can't let on."
Then he praised the cloth that he couldn't see, and assured them of his joy at the beautiful colours and the lovely pattern.
"Yes, it's quite the most charming of all," he told the emperor.
Everyone in town was talking about the magnificent cloth. Then the emperor wanted to see it for himself while it was still on the loom. With an entire host of hand-picked men, including both of the venerable officials who had been there before, he went over to visit the 2 cunning swindlers, who were now weaving with all their might, but without thread or yarn.
"Yes, isn't it magnifique?" said both of the venerable officials. "Just look, Your Majesty, what a pattern, what colours!"
And then they pointed at the empty loom, because they thought that surely the others could see the cloth.
"What's this?" thought the emperor. "I can't see a thing. This is terrible. Am I stupid? Am I unfit to be the emperor? This is the most horrible thing that could happen to me." "Oh, it's very beautiful," the emperor said. "I give it my highest approval."
And he nodded contentedly and looked at the empty loom. He didn't want to say that he couldn't see a thing. The whole entourage he had brought with him looked and looked, but they could make no more of it than all the others. Yet, like the emperor, they said, "Oh, it's very beautiful," and they advised him to wear these splendid new clothes for the first time during the great procession.
"It's magnifique!
"Exquisite! Excellent!" passed from mouth to mouth. Everyone was so genuinely pleased. The Emperor awarded each of the swindlers a knight's cross to put in his buttonhole, and the title of Weaving Squire. The swindlers stayed up all night long, with more than 16 candles burning before the morning of the procession. Everyone could see that they were busy finishing the Emperor's new clothes. They pretended to take the cloth off the loom. They cut at the air with big shears. They sewed with needles, but no thread. And at last they said, "See, now the clothes are done." The Emperor himself came, along with his most distinguished courtiers, and both the swindlers raised one arm in the air as if they were holding something up, and said, "See, here are the trousers. Here is the dress coat. Here is the train." And they kept on in this manner. "They're as light as spider webs. It's almost like having nothing on, but that's exactly their virtue."
"Yes,"
said all the courtiers. But they couldn't see a thing, because there was nothing to see. "Would it please His Imperial Majesty most graciously to take off his clothes?" asked the swindlers. "Then we'll help him into the new ones in front of the big mirror." The Emperor took off all his clothes, and the swindlers acted as if they were handing him each piece of new clothing that they had supposedly sewn, and the Emperor twisted and turned in front of the mirror.
"Lord, how well they suit you! How delightfully they fit!" they all said. "What a pattern! What colours! What priceless attire! Outside they're waiting with the canopy that will be raised above His Majesty for the procession," said the chief master of ceremonies. "All right, I'm ready," said the Emperor. "They fit well, don't they?"
And then he turned around one more time in front of the mirror, trying to look as if he were examining his finery. The chamberlains, who were going to carry the train, fumbled their hands over the floor as if they were picking up the train. They started walking, holding on to air. They didn't dare let on that they couldn't see a thing. Then the Emperor walked in the procession beneath the lovely canopy, and all the people on the street and in the windows said, "Good Lord, our Emperor's new clothes are beyond compare! What a lovely train he has on his coat! How heavenly it fits!" No one wanted to admit that he couldn't see a thing, because then he would have been unfit for his position, or very stupid. None of the Emperor's clothes had ever aroused such admiration.
"But he doesn't have anything on," said a little child.
"Good Lord, listen to the voice of the innocent," said the father.
And one person whispered to the next what the child had said.
"But he doesn't have anything on," the entire crowd cried at last.
The Emperor cringed because he thought they were right. But then he reasoned,
"I have to make it through the procession."
He held himself even prouder than before, and the chamberlains walked along, carrying the train that was not there at all. The Steadfast Tin Soldier. Once upon a time, there were 25 tin soldiers. They were brothers, because they were all born from an old tin spoon. Rifles they held at their shoulders, and their faces looked straight ahead. Red and blue, and oh, so lovely were their uniforms. When the lid was removed from the box in which they lay, the very first words they heard in the world were,
"Tin soldiers!"
That's what a little boy cried, clapping his hands. They had been given to him because it was his birthday, and now he lined them up on the table. Each soldier looked exactly like the next, except for one who was slightly different. He had only one leg, because he was the last to be cast, and there wasn't enough tin left. Yet he stood just as firmly on one leg as the others did on two, and he's the one who turned out to be remarkable. On the table where they stood were many other toys, but the one that was most striking was a charming castle made out of paper. Through the tiny windows you could see right into the halls. Outside stood small trees around a little mirror that was meant to look like a lake. Swans made of wax were swimming around on it, reflected in the mirror. The whole thing was so charming, and yet the most charming of all was a little maiden who stood in the open doorway to the castle. She had also been cut out of paper, but she was wearing a skirt of the sheerest tulle and a tiny, narrow blue ribbon over her shoulder like a sash. In the middle sat a gleaming spangle as big as her face. The little maiden was stretching out both arms, because she was a dancer, and she was also lifting one leg so high in the air that the tin soldier couldn't see it at all, and he thought that she had only one leg, just like him. "Now there's a wife for me," he thought. "But she looks rather refined, and she lives in a castle. I have only a box, and it has to hold 25 of us. That's no place for her. Still, I have to see about making her acquaintance." And then he stretched out full length behind a snuff box that stood on the table. From there he could get a good look at the elegant little lady, who continued to stand on one leg without losing her balance. Later that evening, all the other tin soldiers were put back in their box and the people of the house went to bed. Then the toys began to play. They gave tea parties, fought battles, and danced. The tin soldiers rattled in their box because they wanted to play too, but they couldn't open the lid. The nutcracker turned somersaults, and the slate pencil scribbled all over the slate. There was such a commotion that the canary woke up and started chattering too, and in verse of all things. The only two who didn't budge were the tin soldier and the little dancer. She held herself erect on her toes with her arms held out. He was just as steadfast on one leg, and his eyes didn't leave her for a second. Then the clock struck 12, and bam! The lid of the snuff box flew open, but there was no tobacco inside. No, there was a little black troll. What a wily trick that was!
"Tin soldier," said the troll, "keep your eyes to yourself."
But the tin soldier pretended not to hear him.
"Well, just wait till morning," said the troll.
When morning came and the children got up, the tin soldier was moved over to the windowsill. And whether it was the troll or a gust of wind, all of a sudden the window flew open and the soldier plummeted head first from the fourth floor. What a terrifying speed, with his leg turned upward! He landed on his cap, with his bayonet stuck between the cobblestones. The servant girl and the little boy went downstairs at once to look for him, but even though they nearly stepped on him, they couldn't see him. If the tin soldier had shouted, "Here I am," they probably would have found him, but he didn't think it was proper to yell when he was in uniform. Then it started to rain. One drop came down faster than the other. It turned into a regular downpour. When it was over, two street urchins came along.
"Aye, look," said one of them, "there's a tin soldier lying here. Let's send him out for a sail."
And so they made a boat out of newspaper, set the tin soldier in the middle of it, and he sailed off down the gutter. The two boys ran alongside, clapping their hands. God save us, what waves there were in that gutter, and what a current! Well, it's true that there had just been a downpour. The paper boat pitched up and down, and at times it would spin so fast that the tin soldier swayed, but he remained steadfast, his expression unflinching, standing erect with his rifle at his shoulder. All of a sudden, the boat washed in under a plank that lay over the gutter. It grew just as dark as inside his box. "I wonder where I'll end up now," he thought. Yes, well, this is all the troll's fault. Oh, if only the little maiden were sitting here in the boat, then I wouldn't care if it was twice as dark. At that moment, a big water rat appeared. It lived under the gutter plank.
"Have you got a travel pass?" asked the rat. "Let's see your travel pass."
But the tin soldier didn't say a word, holding his rifle even tighter. The boat raced along with a rat right behind. Oh, how it gnashed its teeth, shouting to sticks and pieces of straw.
"Stop him! Stop him! He didn't pay the toll! He didn't show his travel pass!"
But the current grew stronger and stronger. The tin soldier could already glimpse daylight up ahead where the plank ended, but he also heard a roaring sound that would scare even a brave man. Just imagine. Where the plank ended, the gutter plunged right into a huge canal. For him it would be just as dangerous as for us to sail over an enormous waterfall. He was already so close that he couldn't stop. The boat rushed forward. The poor tin soldier held himself as upright as he could. No one was going to say that he so much as blinked an eye. The boat spun around 3 or 4 times and filled with water up to the rim. It was going to sink. The tin soldier was standing in water up to his neck, and the boat sank deeper and deeper. The paper began dissolving faster and faster. Then the water was over the soldier's head. That's when he thought about the charming little dancer whom he would never see again. And in his ears the soldier heard, "Flee, warrior, flee! Death is after you!" Then the paper fell apart, and the tin soldier plunged right through. But at that very instant he was swallowed by a big fish. Oh, how dark it was inside! It was even worse than under the gutter plank, and it was much more cramped. But the tin soldier was steadfast, and stretched out full length with his rifle at his shoulder. The fish thrashed about, making the most terrifying movements. Finally it grew quite still, and what looked like a bolt of lightning flashed through it. The light shone so bright, and someone cried loudly, "Tin soldier!" The fish had been caught, brought to market, sold, and then ended up in a kitchen where the servant girl slit it open with a big knife. Putting 2 fingers around his waist, she plucked out the soldier and carried him into the parlour, where everyone wanted to see the remarkable man who had travelled inside the belly of a fish. But the tin soldier was not the least bit proud of himself. They set him on the table, and there, oh, what strange things can happen in the world! The tin soldier was in the very same parlour where he had been before. He saw the very same children, and the toys on the table, and the lovely castle with the charming little dancer. She was still standing on one leg, with the other lifted high in the air. She, too, was steadfast. The tin soldier was touched. He was just about to weep tears of tin, but that wouldn't be proper. He looked at her, and she looked at him, but neither said a word. At that moment, one of the little boys picked up the soldier and tossed him right into the stove, giving no explanation at all. The troll in the box was most certainly to blame. The tin soldier stood there, brightly lit, and felt a terrible heat. But whether it was from the actual fire or from love, he didn't know. The paint had worn right off him, but whether this had happened on his journey or from sorrow, no one could say. He looked at the little maiden. She looked at him, and he felt himself melting. But he still stood there, steadfast, with his rifle at his shoulder. Then a door opened. The wind seized hold of the dancer, and she flew like a sylph right into the stove to the tin soldier, burst into flame, and was gone. Then the tin soldier melted into a lump, and the next day, when the servant girl took out the ashes, she found him in the shape of a little tin heart. But all that was left of the dancer was the spangle, and that had been burned black as coal.
The Wild Swans. Far away from here, where the swallows fly when we have winter, there lived a king who had 11 sons and 1 daughter, Elisa. The 11 brothers, who were princes, went to school wearing stars on their chest and swords at their side. They wrote on golden slates with diamond pencils and could recite just as well from memory as from a book. You could hear at once that they were princes. Their sister Elisa sat on a little stool made of mirrors, holding a picture book that had cost half the kingdom. Oh, those children lived so well! But things wouldn't always be that way. Their father, who was king of all the land, married an evil queen who was not the least bit kind to the poor children. Even on the very first day they noticed it. Throughout the whole palace there were great festivities, and the children were playing tea party. But instead of giving them all the cakes and baked apples that could be found, the queen gave them only sand in a teacup and told them to make believe it was something good. The following week the queen sent little Elisa out to the country to some farm folks, and it wasn't long before she had duped the king into thinking so badly of the poor princes that he no longer cared for them at all. "Fly off into the world and fend for yourselves," said the evil queen. "Fly like great birds without a voice." Yet she couldn't make it quite as bad as she intended. They turned into 11 lovely wild swans. Uttering a strange shriek, they flew out the castle windows, over the park and the forest. It was still quite early in the morning when they came upon their sister, Elisa, who was sleeping in the farmer's house. Here they hovered above the roof, twisting their long necks and beating their wings, but no one saw or heard them. They had to take off again, climbing high up toward the clouds, far away into the wide world. There they flew into a big dark forest that stretched all the way down to the shore. Poor little Elisa stood in the farmer's house, playing with a green leaf. She had no other playthings. She stuck a hole in the leaf, peeking through it at the sun. Then she seemed to see the clear eyes of her brothers, and each time the warm rays of the sun shone on her cheek, she would think about all their kisses. Each day passed like the one before. When the wind blew through the big rose hedges outside the house, it would whisper, "Who could be more beautiful than you?" But the roses shook their heads and said, "Elisa is." And if the old woman sat in the doorway on Sunday reading her hymnal, the wind would turn the pages and say to the book, "Who could be more pious than you?" "Elisa is," said the hymnal. And that was the honest truth, what the roses and the hymnal had said. When she was 15, Elisa returned home. And when the queen saw how beautiful Elisa was, she grew angry and hateful. She would gladly have turned her into a wild swan like her brothers, but she didn't dare do so at once, since the king wanted to see his daughter. Early in the morning, the queen went into the bathhouse, which was built of marble and adorned with soft cushions and the loveliest tapestries. She brought 3 toads, kissed them, and said to the first one, "Sit on Elisa's head when she gets into the bath, so that she grows as sluggish as you are." To the second, she said, "Sit on her forehead so she'll be as ugly as you are, and her father won't recognize her." To the third, she whispered, "Rest on her heart. Give her an evil soul that will make her suffer." Then she put the toads into the clear water, which promptly turned a greenish color. She called for Elisa, undressed her, and made her step into the water. As she ducked under, one of the toads sat in her hair, the second on her forehead, and the third on her breast, but Elisa didn't seem to notice at all. As soon as she stood up, 3 red poppies appeared, floating in the water. If the animals hadn't been poisonous and kissed by the witch, they would have been transformed into red roses, but flowers they became all the same, by resting on her head and her heart. She was too innocent and pious for the sorcery to have any power over her. When the evil queen saw this, she rubbed Elisa with walnut juice, so she turned dark brown, smearing her beautiful face with a stinking salve and leaving her lovely hair all tangled. It was impossible to recognize the beautiful Elisa. That's why, when her father saw her, he was quite horrified and said that she was not his daughter. No one else would have recognized her either, except for the watchdog and swallows, but they were humble creatures and had nothing to say in the matter. Then poor Elisa wept and thought about her 11 brothers who had all vanished. Sadly, she crept out of the castle and walked all day over field and marsh and into the great forest. She had no idea where she was going, but she felt so sad and longed for her brothers. No doubt they too had been chased out into the world. She would go looking for them and find them. Not long after she entered the forest, night fell. She had wandered far from any road or path. Then she lay down on the soft moss, said her evening prayer, and leaned her head against a stump. It was quiet, the air was mild, and all around in the grass and on the moss, like a green fire, shimmered more than 100 glowworms. When she gently touched one of the branches with her hand, the glittering insects fell toward her like shooting stars. All night long she dreamed about her brothers. They were playing again, as children, writing on the golden slates with diamond pencils and looking at the lovely picture book that had cost half the kingdom. But on the slate they didn't draw just circles and lines as they had before, but rather the most daring deeds they had carried out, everything they had seen and experienced. And in the picture book, everything was alive. The birds sang, and people stepped out of the book and spoke to Elisa and her brothers, but when she turned the page, they leaped back in so the pictures wouldn't get out of order. When she awoke, the sun was already high overhead. She couldn't actually see it, because the tall trees had spread out their branches thick and dense, but its rays played above her like a rippling golden veil. There was a fragrance of fresh nature, and the birds seemed about to land on her shoulders. She heard water splashing. There were many large springs, all feeding into a pond with the loveliest sandy bottom. It's true that thick shrubbery grew all around, but in one spot the deer had dug a big opening, and this was where Elisa went down to the water. It was so clear that if the wind hadn't rustled the branches and the shrubs, making them move, she would have thought they were painted on the bottom, so sharply was each leaf reflected, both those that the sun shone through and those entirely in shadow. As soon as she saw her own face, she grew quite frightened. It was so brown and horrid. But when she made her little hand wet and rubbed her eyes and forehead, her white skin shone through. Then she took off all her clothes and stepped into the fresh water. A more lovely royal child could not be found in this world. When she had put her clothes back on and braided her long hair, she went over to the bubbling spring, drank from the hollow of her hand, and then wandered deeper into the forest without knowing where she was headed. She thought about her brothers, thought about the good Lord who surely would not abandon her. He had made the wild crab apples grow to feed the hungry. He showed her such a tree where the branches were weighed down by fruit. Here she ate her midday meal and then propped up its branches. Then she entered the darkest part of the forest. It was so quiet that she could hear every little withered leaf that crumpled underfoot. Not a bird was in sight. Not a ray of sun could penetrate the huge, dense tree branches. The tall trunks stood so close together that when she looked straight ahead, it was like a grating of timber surrounding her. Oh, here was a loneliness that she had never known before. The night was so dark. Not a single little glowworm gleamed from the moss. Sadly, she lay down to sleep. Then it seemed to her that the tree branches overhead moved aside, and our Lord looked down on her with gentle eyes, and little angels peeked out above his head and under his arms. When she awoke in the morning, she didn't know whether she had dreamed it or whether it had actually happened. She went on a few paces and came upon an old woman carrying a basket of berries. The old woman gave her some of them. Elisa asked whether she had seen 11 princes riding through the forest.
No, said the old woman, but yesterday I saw 11 swans with gold crowns on their heads swimming along the stream nearby.
And she led Elisa some distance away to a slope. Down below wound a stream. The trees on its banks stretched out their long leafy branches toward each other, and wherever they couldn't reach because of their natural growth, there they had pulled their roots loose from the earth and leaned out over the water to intertwine their branches. Elisa said farewell to the old woman and walked along the stream to the place where it flowed out onto the vast open seashore. The whole lovely ocean lay before the young girl, but not a sailing ship was in sight, not a boat could be seen. How was she going to journey any farther? She looked at the countless pebbles along the shore. The water had worn all of them smooth. Glass, iron, stone, everything that had washed up had been shaped by the water, and yet it was even softer than her delicate hand. It keeps on rolling tirelessly, and then it smooths out whatever is hard. I will be just as tireless. Thank you for your wisdom, you clear rolling waves. My heart tells me that some day you will carry me to my dear brothers. Amid the washed-up seaweed lay 11 white swan feathers. She gathered them into a bouquet. Drops of water lay on them, but whether they were mist or tears, it was impossible to tell. It was lonely at the seashore, but she didn't notice, because the sea offered endless variations. Yes, more in a few hours than the inland lakes could display in a whole year. If a big black cloud passed by, it was as if the sea wanted to say, "I too can look dark." Then the wind would blow and the waves would turn their white side out. But when the clouds glowed crimson and the winds were asleep, the sea was like a rose petal. First it would turn green, then white, but no matter how calmly it rested, there was still a gentle movement at the shore. The water rose faintly, like the breast of a sleeping child. When the sun was about to set, Elisa saw 11 wild swans with gold crowns on their heads come flying toward land. They glided one after the other like a long white ribbon. Then Elisa climbed up the slope and hid behind a shrub. The swans landed near her, flapping their great white wings. As soon as the sun sank below the water, the swans shed their skins, and there stood 11 handsome princes, Elisa's brothers. She uttered a loud cry, because even though they had changed greatly, she knew it was them, felt sure it had to be them. And she flung herself into their arms, calling them by name.